I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Ayelet Waldman is a writer of fiction, nonfiction, essays, and even television. Her new book, A Perfect Hand, is her first novel in over a decade. The book follows a lady's maid in 19th century England who creates her own marriage plot with a servant in another household. Waldman fully credits the idea to her daughter, Sophie Chabon, and the result reads almost like a cross between Jane Austen and Downton Abbey, two of Waldman's favorites. I recently spoke with Ayelet Waldman about the book, how she conducts her research, and about her love for themes of longing. Here's our conversation. So the book opens with the description of Alice Locky, a lady's maid, or Abigail, to Lady Jemima Alderwick. For our listeners, can you set up the book for us? What should we know about Alice and the world in which she lives?
So what's most important is that Alice is a working class girl. She's the daughter of a farmer, and her father is a tenant on the estate of Lord Alderwick, which is, you know, think Jane Austen or Downton Abbey, one of those beautiful, gracious English countryside estates. And this is in the 19th century, in the latter part of the 19th century. And when we say Victorian England, it's such a long period because Queen Victoria ruled and lived forever, but it's around the, you know, sort of in the latter part, 1860s, 1870s.
So we meet Alice and another character, Charlie, and that's when they meet each other. Through most of the book, the two have like a plot scheming. What's happening here?
So they meet. Charlie is the valet. That's how you pronounce that. I did not know it. It's not like a car valet. It's a valet. Charlie is the valet to Sir Nigel, who is visiting the estate of the Alderwicks. There were these visiting parties in that time where you would go and you would spend a week, sometimes two, sometimes longer, hunting and fishing and generally being a society person. Because don't forget, none of these people actually worked. It was a gentleman didn't work. So they just sort of hopped from one another's houses doing, you know, leisure activities. So Charlie is there with the lord that he works for. And the two, Alice and Charlie, meet below stairs in the servants' quarters and they fall in love. And the problem is that they each work for someone different and they can't live together. They live, you know, Charlie lives in one part of England, Alice lives in another, and they come up with a scheme to convince the people they work for, Lady Jemima and Sir Nigel, to fall in love. And if they fall in love and marry, then these two, Alice and Charlie, can keep their jobs, but they can live together and work together in the same house.
You know, you're talking about the staff, and I was fascinated by the inner workings of a household and the politics among the help. Talk to me about Alice's relationship with the other staff, and not just in the house where she works, because the atmosphere would vary from house to house, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So Alice is a little bit of a curious situation because a lady's maid, it was very fashionable to have a lady's maid from France or from Germany. And fancy ladies would usually hire someone from abroad. But in Alice's case, she works for the daughter of this house. And she actually grew up on the estate. She came to the house as a junior maid and worked her way up because she had a relationship with Lady Jemima from the time they were both very young. And Lady Jemima is still a girl. She's in her early 20s, as is Alice. So Alice has this curious relationship because many people in the house knew her when she was a junior maid. So she was just Alice. But now that she is a lady's maid, she should be known by her surname. She should be known as Locky. And this is a really big house with a lot of servants, and it's very formal and very stiff. But then part of the action happens in London at the house of Lady Jemima's aunt, her mother's sister. And this is a small house. They're just a handful of servants, and they're much more casual, and they're London people. They're a little earthier and a little warmer. They have to share a bed. Alice has to share bed with the housekeeper because there's not enough room in the Alderwick estate. There's a whole floor full of servants' rooms. There's like the male servant side and the female servant side, and maybe two maids would share a room, but they certainly wouldn't share a bed. But in this house, which is more cozy and comfortable and also friendlier, they double bunk.
You know, within the first few pages of the book is a reference to the title. The quote is, "Ironically, but for years of rough labor, Alice herself might have had a perfect hand." Can you talk to me about the title?
So in Victorian England, there was this notion, this concept of the perfect hand, and it was like this beautiful, pale white hand, you know, where there was no work that was done. You know, there's a little needle work, but your hands were kind of smooth and soft, and there wouldn't be a callus, there wouldn't be a hangnail. And this was a lady's hand, right? Because a working woman's hand would, you know, Alice spends a lot of her time like scrubbing. She has to get stains out. You know, she sends Lady Jemima's clothes to the laundry, but she's responsible for like the stains, the intimate stains, which you can imagine, cleaning her shoes, which in Lady Jemima's case are a little bit disgusting because she has stinky feet, and needlework and all of this stuff. You know, the lady's maid would make all the cosmetics. You know, she would create from lanolin and other things these cosmetics that she would use on her employer's face and body. So she has a working woman's hands, but she actually is very, very shapely and she's beautiful. And if she, the idea there is that like, this is a person who in a different time or place would be in a very different circumstance of life. And I'm trying to show there how these two women, these two very young women, Lady Jemima and Alice, they live in a certain way because of the class they were born into, but their lives would have been very different in a merit society based on merit, a society that wasn't so firmly based on birth.
An essential piece of this story is the influence that books of the time have on Alice and those around her. There are references to Jane Austen's Emma and Pride and Prejudice, Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, George Eliot, John Stuart Mill, and multiple works by Mary Wollstonecraft. How did you determine which works would lend themselves to the story in your book?
So, you know, it's so interesting to me. Writers are readers first. I have never met a writer who wasn't a voracious reader as a child. It is like my primary hobby and occupation. I'm also a quilter, let's be clear, but I listen to audiobooks all the time when I quilt. But it always surprises me the way nobody reads in so many works of fiction. And that always is a shock to me because here these books are written by people who spend so much of their time reading, but nobody's reading in them. It's so strange, you know? So I always try to have my characters read, and especially in a book like this, which is so, you know, I wrote this book because these are the works of fiction that I love. I reread all of Jane Austen, Northanger Abbey, let's be real. But I read all the rest of Jane Austen every year. I don't even do it consciously. I just, at some point I'm like, oh, there's something wrong. I feel itchy. Oh, it's because I haven't read Jane Austen recently enough. And so I wanted to put all those works that I really loved into this book. And it also, fiction was such a huge part of the lives of people. You know, they didn't have movies, they didn't have television. Outings were sort of, people would go to plays, but those cost a lot more money. And reading books was, it was both a sign that you had some leisure time, but it was also like a source of tremendous joy for people. I mean, you know, we all heard those stories that when Charles Dickens wrote books serially, and when that serialized chapter would show up on the docks in New York, there would be a riot because people would have been waiting for the next chapter of David Copperfield, you know, tearing out their hair, wondering what was going on. And then they would hear that it was arriving on a boat and they would all like race to the docks to be the first to get that chapter. So I wanted to make sure that those books featured, but then I also wanted to make sure that they were thematically connected. So Emma is a book about a bossy, busybody girl who spends her time matchmaking to terrible effect. So that's kind of like a hint of some of what's going to happen in my novel. And then, you know, Dickens wrote a lot about class and about the lot of the working person in England. And so that's something that was thematically related. And Mary Wollstonecraft and John Stuart Mill were early feminist writers. And the fight for women's suffrage and that very first kind of notion of women's rights is hugely important in the book. So you see those there. I mean, I made my way through some 50 dense tomes when I was writing this. You know, I'd read Mary Wollstonecraft probably because it was assigned in college, but I was like, oh, I'll read some Mary Wollstonecraft. And I was like, oh my God, okay, everybody be quiet. Mommy has to read a book that's very dense right now.
Do you have a favorite Jane Austen?
Yes, my favorite Jane Austen is Persuasion, which I know is not supposed to be my favorite because Mansfield Park, you know, there's Vladimir Nabokov famously said that Mansfield Park was the best Jane Austen. It was like one of his perfect novels. I find that book really frustrating because the heroine, Fanny, is such a limp toast. I'm just like, come on, get a spine, do something. But I love Persuasion. It has this quality of longing that I really like. So in Persuasion, this young woman is persuaded by her mother's dear friend, who is kind of acts as her mother in this way after her mother dies, to reject the suit of a young man that she loves because he has no prospects. And then the novel, so this is what happened before the novel in the past. And then she never marries. She holds a torch for him forever. And then he returns. He's a captain in the Navy, and he returns and he's fabulously wealthy. But from his point of view, she rejected him when he was poor, and he doesn't, you know, he's angry. He's hurt. He loved her. So the book is about that. It's about that kind of longing that they each feel for each other. And I am a sucker for longing, which maybe explains why I have watched Heated Rivalry 10 times all the way through. My husband said, are you going to insert Heated Rivalry into every interview you have about your book? And I'm like, perhaps. Yes, I might.
Well, Persuasion is my favorite too.
Is it? Yay. Why do you love it?
I love it because it had a different tone than the rest of them. I mean, there's some misunderstanding, but she never stopped loving him and he never stopped loving her. And right. it was the outside forces that separated them. Whereas, you know, in some of the other books, it's their own pride or their own stupidity or their own blindness that separates them. But these two were separated not because of their own choosing, to me.
I think so too. And I feel like that love seems really true to me.
Yeah.
Like it feels like that kind of young infatuation. It feels very familiar to me, you know, and there's something like sometimes Pride and Prejudice, which I love, sometimes that sort of Elizabeth's, when she makes that turn, when she falls in love, it's at this beautiful mansion and she's like, oh, is this who this guy is? Huh? And that, like, I love that. You know, my grandmother used to say, it's just as easy to marry a rich man as a poor man. Not necessarily true, but so I get that. Like, if I saw that house, I don't know, maybe I'd be like, oh, I can love this guy. But there's something that feels really true and almost pure to me about the love story in Persuasion, which is why it's my favorite.
You're listening to Marginalia. We're speaking with the author, Ayelet Waldman, about her novel, A Perfect Hand. You know, as much as I want to keep talking about Jane Austen, let's get back to your novel. There is a shift in the novel as Alice moves from prioritizing her romance with Charlie Wells to a curiosity about social issues, particularly women's suffrage. What fascinates Alice about advocacy work?
So, you know, like I said before, Alice started as a lower maid. She's first, you know, she's the daughter of a tenant farmer. Her journey to this sort of lofty status in the house, the status of lady's maid, is unusual. And a girl who would do that, who would have that kind of ambition, is an unusual person. And that ambition for her didn't stop. She found herself in this job. She's very pleased with it. But she's the kind of young woman who has a drive, who sees a future in a way that many people in that time period didn't actually see a future for themselves. They were born into a status. They lived in that status. They died in that status. But she's a really unusual kind of person. So in Victorian England, the world was starting to change and people were starting to have ideas that were sort of outside of you know, this ability to say, hey, the world doesn't always have to look like this. And a lot of the lower classes doesn't always have to look like that. So that is something that really captures Alice's attention because of the kind of person that she is. And I see the book really as her sort of coming into herself and learning as she sort of transitions from being a young woman to a sort of slightly older woman, that the things that she wants in her life, the imagination she has for her future develops and grows and changes, and along with the world outside her.
Talk to me about the research you had to do for this novel, you know, regarding
so much.
Setting and character and plot.
I love writing historical fiction because I love the research. So this is the second historical novel I've written. The first one was called Love and Treasure. And I mean, research is so much fun for me. I mean, what's research? It's reading. I mean, so then you get to like lie around and read and feel like you're going to work. Like what's more exciting than that? So for this book, I always create kind of a bookshelf for every book, whether it's historical or not. I have in my studio, I have this like long bookshelf. And the first thing I do is buy a bunch of books, and they're almost like good luck charms. And sometimes I don't even read all of them, but I have, so my shelf for this book had a huge library of sort of this discussion of the servants class in Victorian and Georgian and Regency England. It had sort of even handbooks on how to do the work. There's a great handbook called The Duties of a Lady's Maid, which had everything from, you know, how you're supposed to be religious and what your relationship is, how you're supposed to talk, and then how you scrub out a stain and what kind of hairstyle you're supposed to do. And then I had other handbooks for how to, you know, the servant class and how to organize a house, handbooks for upper class ladies on what your house should look like, how it should be organized, what your relationship with your staff should be. And then I had this kind of like early, almost proto-feminism part of my bookshelf with works on the very early notions of women's rights and the very earliest moments of the battle for women's suffrage, for the vote. So it was just, I did a tremendous amount of reading. Obviously, I did a lot of research online. The Victoria and Albert Museum has these amazing collections of textiles and dresses. And I spent a lot of time looking at those. Those were really fun. They also, if you're ever going to England, have the best museum cafe. I love a museum cafe. And this one, you know, you can get like everything from scones and clotted cream to the every imagination you have of food in England. I went to England, of course, because I had to. Of course I did. I had to go and, you know, really walk around and where my characters would have walked around and have a great old time there. So the research part was really fun. But here's the thing with research. You could do it forever. But the real job of a writer is sitting your butt down in the chair. There's this great German word called, I'm never going to pronounce this right, but it's like Seisfleisch. It's like the work of your behind. Sit your butt down in the chair and get your writing done. And at some point I always say to myself, all right, enough of this dilly-dallying. Sit down, start writing. You know enough now. Because I think there can also be a danger in historical fiction where you know so much, you've learned so much, and you're trying to cram everything you know into the book, almost like to show off, like, hey, I did this and I researched that, and here's a fact you might not know. And you kind of got to clean those out, because I feel like as a reader, that can kind of take me out of the story and the characters. So at some point I say to myself, you know enough, and if you keep this up, you're going to know too much. Get busy.
You know, I asked about research of setting, character, and plot, but I'm also thinking about the writing style as well. The tone and tenor reflect the time period of the late 1800s and the language of the time. I mean, I circled so many words that I had to look up. The book reads in a formal tone that we don't see today. Was this a challenge to master?
Sure. First of all, I'm not English. And I wasn't, you know, alive then. So yeah, really. And that was one of my inspirations, was trying to capture the tone of the books that I love. You know, I just love it. I love that. I love a marriage plot. I love those stories. And I love the language. Jane Austen was the first writer I read where I understood what language was. I had this crazy experience when I was a girl. I would ride my bike down to the library, and there was this rack. It was like a spinner rack by the checkout desk, and it was full of Gothic romances. You know, those, they were mass market paperbacks. They were like, every cover was like a busty woman in a fancy dress and then a dark guy like in the back. And I would read just dozens and dozens of those. I would take like six or seven home every week and gobble them up. And at one point, there was a librarian who was watching me. And she said to me, "Oh, you love these books?" I'm like, "Oh, I love them. I love them." And they were romances and always had a happy ending. And she said, "Well, you should consider this book too." And she hands me this book. And it looks like the others. It's a mass market paperback. And like the only difference was maybe the young woman on the cover had less kind of cleavage on in her dress. So I took it home, and that was Pride and Prejudice. And it was reading the language of that book that really exploded my mind and made me see style and see language and the quality of the writing for the first time. So it was really important to me to try to capture that. And it was hard work, you know. I mean, it's not the kind of natural language, but it was almost like a car shifting into gear when I started writing. Like all of a sudden, I just felt myself lock in. And it felt effortless, although at the end of a workday, I was pretty tired. Like I could feel my brain was tired. And then I hired a bunch of people. I hired two Oxford students who were specialists in the period to check both my language and then also my Britishisms. I remember reading once a novel by a contemporary British novelist set in America. And an American character in this novel makes a phone call to another American character, but in the narration of the novel, he rings the other character. And that just kind of took me out of it. So I knew I didn't want to have any mistakes in that. And then I hired this amazing American professor of the Victorian period to make sure all my period details were right, and another person to check my British stuff. So I really wanted to make sure all that language hit. And they found lots of things. They were like, "No, this, you would say this and you would say that, and maybe, you know, turn this word around." And but what was surprising actually is how I kind of nailed it. For a long time, I kept a little notebook where I wrote down phrases from different Victorian novels that I read that I wanted to, like, you know, to sort of steal. That's like the secret of writers. You know, we all hate plagiarism and we all steal words all the time. All the time. Like, you know, a sentence will sort of capture our imagination and we'll kind of rewrite it a little bit and steal it. The trick is you have to steal from writers who write better than you do. That's how you make sure your writing is good. So, and by steal, I mean, you know, filtered through your own imagination. I'm not saying go plagiarize, you know, your favorite writer's books. That was the most fun part of writing this novel for me, was writing in a tone, in a language that was so different from my own.
After you quit writing for the day, did the language and delivery follow you in your everyday life?
Sometimes, yeah. I'm an accent sponge anyway. That's like it embarrasses my children so much if we're traveling. Like, we'll be in England, say, on vacation, and I'll be like, "Sorry, sorry." Or we'll be talking to, you know, even if it's on the phone and I'm calling customer service and it's in the South, by the end of the call, I'm talking like it's like some terrible fake Southern accent, which, you know, my kids are just sitting like, "Oh God, Mom." So yeah, it would definitely bleed in. But when I go out on book tour, you read from the book, and this book is not written in American English, so I have to fake a British accent when I do my readings. So I have a dear friend, the British novelist Naomi Alderman, and we did, I'm going to post this on the internet. We did this hilarious, like, British accent lesson. Oh, and I recorded it, where she's trying to teach me how to say, like, Alderwick, Alderwick, not Alderwick. And she's trying to, like, you know, she's correcting all my pronunciations. And it's pretty hilarious. Like, if you come to a reading of mine, you're going to hear me read in a bad British accent, but it'll be better than reading it in a, I mean, it's probably going to end up being really funny, but that's part of the game.
So your dedication reads to Sophie, whose idea it was. And you also refer to this in the acknowledgments. Can you tell us who Sophie is and about her ultimate literary sacrifice?
Yes. So Sophie is my oldest daughter. She's working on her first novel. And I had a really hard time. You see, this novel comes out like a full dozen years after my last novel, 9 years after my last book, a dozen years after my last novel, which is crazy. I am not a person who takes that long to write a book. And I had a sojourn in Hollywood, notoriously the place where novelists go to never be heard from again. Even the greats like F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hollywood destroyed them. But so I had a long stretch in Hollywood. But I kept trying to come up with an idea for my new book. And I always used to say, ideas are cheap. I got nothing about ideas. And in a way, that's true. I just kept starting new manuscripts and thinking this is a good idea for a book, and then not liking it and putting it aside and starting another one, putting it aside. I mean, there were so many books that I started. I can't even count them. And then one day I remember I was lying on the couch and I was just like whining, like, oh, I can't do this anymore. I can't think of a book. I'm never going to think of a book. And my oldest daughter said, oh God, Mom, stop it. Here's what you need to do. You love Jane Austen. If you love Downton Abbey, if a movie takes place in the Victorian period, the Regency period, if everybody's wearing ball gowns and, you know, going to parties, you love it automatically. So write a story like that. Write a marriage plot. But here's the thing. Don't write it from the point of view of the lords and ladies. Write it from the point of view of the servants. And I just kind of sat up and I looked at her, and it really was like a light bulb went off in my head. And I just, that day I sat down and I think I wrote for 6 hours. It was incredible. And I just like powered through the book, and it was so much fun. And she, it's funny, I started this long after she started her book, and I'm finished it before, because she is like, you know, it's her first book. She wants it to be perfect. She's working really hard. It is really, really good. But I, at one point I saw her thinking, you know, I gave her this idea and now she's done. That's not fair. But, you know, all's fair in love and literature, man.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from A Perfect Hand?
Yeah, I would say. So, I mean, I don't need to tell you this. We are living in some really unpleasant times, and the tenor of our conversation is so often so ugly online, especially. I mean, even every time you open the newspaper, you think, you know, what fresh hell is this? And I want people to have a little bit of an escape. I want them to have some joy. I feel like, you know, escapism gets a bad rap. We think of it as a negative, but I feel like being able to immerse yourself in a book, in a movie, in a hobby is really important for how we go through the world. And reading is my favorite thing. And I want readers to be able to say, you know what, that was a delight. That rejuvenated me. That makes me feel good about myself, about the world, about, you know, my day. So that's what I hope. That, you know, at the end of a difficult day, someone will be able to, you know, lie down in bed and pick up this novel and have some fun.
Well, the book is A Perfect Hand. I Yell at Waldman. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was so nice talking to you. Thank you so much.
A Perfect Hand by I Yell at Waldman was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.